Kashmir's political sphere and raised many questions on New Delhi's claims of normalcy in the region. At to break the ice, amid tough security measures, New Delhi is holding local elections in 8 phases ending on December 19th. A large number of voters has braved cold weather to vote, and each of them has their own reasons.
Our educated youth are doing menial jobs. We have problems like improper roads and lack of electricity. Who will take up our issues to higher-ups? That's why we voted for our trusted candidate.
Election boycott calls in passed by the pro-independence camp of Kashmir were highly supported by the people of Kashmir. But this time they say they want to fight for equality and justice via elections.
We are seeking respect since we are treated as second-class citizens. The country's progress hardly reaches us. By casting our vote, we tell the champions of democracy to do justice. Earlier, our election boycott was an excuse for them. Now we will give them no excuse. We want equal rights and treatment.
While voters have their own reasons to cast ballots, candidates have their aims too.
I can't promise my people jobs and land rights because with Article 370 everything is gone. My goal is to safeguard my people against the plots of people with anti-Muslim agendas. I believe in peace and tranquility and I want to work for secularism in my block.
The main contesting parties in this local election are Bharatiya Janata Party, Indian National Congress and Alliance of Local Political Parties.
Amid heightened security, the elections in Indian-administered Kashmir are being portrayed by many as a step towards normalcy and peace in the region. However, experts say such electoral processes have hardly helped Kashmir in the past, adding long-lasting peace is only possible when the issue gets permanently resolved between India and Pakistan. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
At the beginning of 2020, as COVID-19 began to spread from China and around the world, health workers and aid agencies predicted that the virus's impact on Yemen's vulnerable population would be catastrophic, forecasting a 90% infection rate. Yet despite its utter affliction so far, the war-torn country appears to have emerged relatively unscathed by the pandemic, reporting just 2,124 cases and 611 deaths to date. Testing facilities and comprehensive data are almost non-existent, so it is highly unlikely the official statistics reflect the coronavirus true impacts. But according to several doctors and healthcare officials in central province of Shabwa, at least the virus is not a pressing concern. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Bethan Makranan under the heading, Yemen in a country stalked by disease, COVID barely registers. This article was published on the Guardian.com website. Please stay tuned. On a ward in Atong General Hospital in the dusty central province of Shabwa in Yemen, six-month-old Mona Bassam is lying on her back, eyes closed, her distended belly moving up and down with the labor of breathing. In the corridor outside her room, a poster shows before and after photos of several children admitted to the ward who have managed to recover from acute malnutrition, still painfully thin but smiling and alert. Mona's family have already taken her to hospital once before, worried about being able to pay for her treatment and fuel to return to the village. Their prayers for her this time around are even more urgent. The baby's grandfather, Abdullah, said, "My wife and I had 20 children. 11 of them died," adding, "But that was a long time ago. This should not still be happening today." Elsewhere, in the overwhelmed hospital, children are suffering with cholera, diphtheria, and dengue fever, contagious diseases that have stalked Yemen since the outbreak of war 6 years ago. For patients and doctors in Yemen in what the UN says is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, coronavirus barely registers. Dr. Ali Nasser Said, the hospital director, says, "We don't have a neurosurgeon. We don't have a maternity ward. We treat 20 children a month for malnutrition, and now we are admitting more and more people severely ill with complications from dengue fever. More than 3,000 cases so far this year. The generator doesn't always keep the equipment on," adding, "Coronavirus is nowhere near our biggest problem." Shabwa, an oil-rich region, has been firmly under the control of government-loyal forces since last summer. The province is relatively wealthy and stable compared with other areas of the country, leading Yemenis displaced by the fighting or migrant workers sent home from Saudi Arabia to settle here. As a result, Shabwa's population has swollen from 600,000 to an estimated 1 million, and concrete and breeze-block building sites on the outskirts of Atar have begun to encroach on the sand. Silk Road caravans used to traverse the tabletop mountains that tower above Shabwa's plains in search of frankincense. Today, they have been replaced by oil pipelines and convoys of tankers. Shabwa's governor, Mohammed Saleh Ben Adio, appointed in 2018, has invested millions in beefing up local security forces and infrastructural projects to try to lure foreign oil companies back to the area. However, the aggressions and attacks by the Western-backed Saudi-led coalition against Ansarullah and the innocent Yemeni civilian shows no sign of stopping anytime soon. For ordinary Yemenis, the impact of war can be blunted only so far. The currency, the rial, has lost 2/3 of its value since the Saudi-led attacks against the innocent civilians began and continues to slide, making it harder and harder to put food on the table. A rise in food prices coupled with devastating aid cuts and blockade by the Saudi regime means the prospect of widespread famine is once again on the horizon. According to a study conducted by UN agencies, serious malnutrition in southern Yemen, including Shawa, has risen to 10% this year and is up 15% among under fives. In a talk market square, everyone is selling but no one is buying. By 11 a.m. local time, glum honey traders and shepherds sit around still waiting to make their first sale of the day. At a CSAM oil shop nearby, owner Khaled is despondent. He says, even if the electricity worked, I've run out of money to pay for it. During Saudi-led attacks, half of the country's healthcare facilities have been destroyed. Hundreds of doctors have martyred. And because of grim economic situation created by the Saudis' attacks and blockade, public sector salaries often go unpaid, putting unsustainable pressure on the hospitals and clinics that remain. At the beginning of 2020, as COVID-19 began to spread from China and around the world, health workers and aid agencies predicted that the virus impact on Yemen's vulnerable population would be catastrophic, forecasting a 90% infection rate. Yet, despite its utter affliction so far, the war-torn country appears to have emerged relatively unscathed by the pandemic, reporting just 2,124 cases and 611 deaths to date. Testing facilities and comprehensive data are almost non-existent. So, it is highly unlikely the official statistics reflect the coronavirus' true impact. But according to several doctors and healthcare officials, in Shawa at least, the virus is not a pressing concern. A gleaming new COVID-19 testing, treatment and quarantine center on the edge of Attock City, regarded as the best facility in the country, hasn't received a single patient since August. Staff in head-to-toe protective gear mill around the state-of-the-art testing machine are disinfecting surfaces for lack of anything better to do during a visit of a group of foreign journalists. The center has conducted nearly 4,000 tests so far, only 90 of which came back positive, and Shawa province as a whole has recorded 46 deaths. Asked why the number of COVID-19 cases in Yemen appears to be so much lower than elsewhere, despite the absence of social distancing and extra hygiene measures, the center's director, Dr. Hisham Said, says high morale and a population that skews young have kept Yemenis safe from the coronavirus. However, he worries that the growing stigma associated with the disease and the difficulty of travel mean people in need of treatment are just staying home. He says, it is very hard to tell what the impact is, adding, people think it's a normal fever. Sometimes they ask me whether coronavirus is all just a big lie. Satellite imagery analysis of graveyards in the southern province of Aden, where COVID-19 appears to have hit hardest, suggests otherwise. A study from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine found that the number of new burials in the area had nearly doubled since the first case of COVID-19 was confirmed in April, and there have been 2,100 excess deaths against an expected baseline of about 1,300 by the end of September. Analysis by the medical charity Med Global published in July found that at least 97 Yemeni healthcare workers had already died of the disease, suggesting that the true case load and mortality figure is far higher than recorded. For now, the peak of the coronavirus pandemic in Yemen, or at least its first wave appears to have subsided, allowing healthcare workers to focus on the country's other urgent health crises. Shabwa's governor, Muhammad Saleh bin Ido, is funding most of the operational costs at Attar General Hospital and spending $2 million on a new hospital complex near the COVID-19 center. Work began on the site in 1994, but the facility was never finished as funding dried up because of war. In 2015, the empty building used as a base by the Ansarullah for a commanding center in order to defend the defenseless Yemenis leading the Saudi-led coalition to bomb it. 5 years later, it has been fully repaired by the Ansarullah movement, and construction workers are installing central air conditioning and lighting systems. Empty corridors smelling of fresh paint await medical equipment that international charities have promised to help provide. The new facility should have 240 beds compared with 140 at Attar General Hospital and will boast dedicated maternity, cardiac and infectious disease wards. A powerful new governor should keep the electricity on for 24 hours a day, allowing monitors and ventilators to function without interruption. Local authorities hope the hospital will come online in early 2021, although many obstacles still stand in the way. Well-trained staff, functioning equipment, and supplies of medicine are never guaranteed because of the Saudi blockade and aggression. The head of pediatrics, Dr. Saleh Al-Khamsi, says, "I lost the little boy last week to dengue fever because we had no antitoxins to give him. I called every hospital in the south, but no one had any. Maybe he could have lived." Adding, "Even if the war ends, I worry that we have already lost a generation."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
No one except for mothers themselves can really understand motherly feelings. However, these mothers sent their youth to the front lines. They said, "I have offered my son in the way of God. I have thankfully had the blessing to regularly and frequently meet with the families of martyrs, with their mothers and fathers. I witnessed that the mothers of martyrs had an astonishing spirit and sense of altruism, which was truly great to an immeasurable extent. This would not have happened if it had not been for Islam and for a great spirit of self-sacrifice, which constitutes a brilliant chapter in the voluminous book of the Sacred Defense. This is another point.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Sayyid
The fifth point is that the sacred defense era stimulated investment for the country, and it engendered valuable assets for the country. The fruits of the sacred defense are many. First of all, the security of the country was achieved thanks to the sacred defense. In other words, the sacred defense showed that one should pay a very high price for attacking and transgressing against our country. This was proved thanks to the sacred defense. This ensures the security of the country. When a nation shows that it has the determination and power to defend itself and to reciprocate aggressors' aggression, this makes transgressors hesitate before launching an attack on this country, and if they wish to act intelligently, they understand that it is not in their best interest, as they would have to pay a very high price. Our security originates from this. Alhamdulillah,
alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Amir Kabir. Khayyam. Maulana. Avicenna, Khwarizmi. Iranian notables, sources of global honor.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in this episode, you will get more familiar with the Iranian poet who lived in 7th and 8th centuries A.H., corresponding to 13th and 14th centuries AD. He was Seyf Faraghani. Seyf Faraghani has been known as a leader of socio-political poetry in Farsi language. The 7th and 8th centuries AH were among the bright eras of Iran's literary history, as masters of poetry and Gnosticism like Maulana, Sa'di, and Hafez lived in that era. We have said that little is known about his life and times. Stay tuned for more. You have also heard that Saifuddin Abu Muhammad Muhammad Faraghani was born in Transoxiana and left his town Farghane for Asia Minor, current Turkey, in youth. He lived the rest of his life in Aksaray, a small town of the region. Dear listeners, you also heard that the Iranian society was so much chaotic due to the Mongol invasion that most of the literary figures and poets lived in fear and tried to survive. What one finds in the works of that era mirrors the pains and misery of people under the Mongol rule. The sufferings of masses were reflected as complaints in the works and poems and writers, or in the form of comedy and farce of poets such as Sa'di Shirazi and Obaid Zakani. There were three groups in the turbulent conditions of that era. The first group was the laymen who didn't understand the causes of the existing conditions and just tolerated them. The second group consisted of politicians who had assimilated themselves with the rulers to preserve their worldly gains. But the third group comprised of responsible writers and men of letters who would either try to advise the ruling class or castigated them through satires and sarcasm. The works remaining from poets and writers are indeed a mirror of the ups and downs of the land that they lived in. Researchers, through examining these works, can find out the way of living, thoughts, customs, religion, and socio-political developments of every people. The literature of protest, as one of the literary genres, has been able to depict the anomalies in the society and also corruption of the ruling system in every era. Saif Barahani can be called one of the leaders of this genre, as protest forms the core of most of his poems. A significant part of poems in Farsi literature used to be dedicated to panegyrics for kings and the royal family or the ministers and even local rulers. These poems were devoid of reality and were mainly flattery. Such poems have never been approved by wise men and even the poets. Most of these eulogies would be done for the sake of financial gains, while a small number of poets were forced to eulogize a king or ruler in order to be immune from the threats on their lives. On the opposite side of the spectrum were the protesters. They were the poets and writers who protested to the status quo and did their best to show their discontent with the government. For sure, such literary men were constantly in danger. However, they would never keep silent in the face of the economic, social, and political corruption. Their works would, in fact, portray the miseries of people. Thus, the laymen would welcome their works, though these literary figures were often homeless, wandering from one place to another. The literature of protest has always been there in the Farsi literature. This genre is like a flag hoisted against social injustice and misrule of kings and governors. The poets who were puppets of rulers and kings were often tacit vis-à-vis the oppression against masses. But the ones who lived among people felt it as their mission to stand up against injustice and corruption. Therefore, they would make use of various literary methods to be the voice of the oppressed and the weak. They would employ farce, irony, satire, sarcasm, comedy, exaggeration, metaphor, and so on to convey their meaning and explain the economic woes of lower classes. At times, they would also use advice and admonishment to convey their meaning. Although many poets and thinkers believe that advice is not effective in awakening kings and disclosing their injustice and corruption. Unfortunately, most of the invading ethnicities would not tolerate the cultural brilliance and supremacy of the Iranian nation. Therefore, instead of trying to cope with the lofty culture and customs of civilized people in the Iranian plateau, they tried to violate their culture and devastate their cultural achievements and honors. There were many poets in various social classes, but it was the Sufi and mystic poets and writers who tried to expose social problems of their era. They would clearly criticize the ruling system's deficiencies and flaws. Saif Farahani was one of such poets. Dear listeners, next time we will continue this discussion.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. In Iran, lawmakers have given the green light to a plan to address the legal sanctions imposed on the country. Iranian parliamentarians want the Rouhani administration to produce 120 kilos of uranium at 20% purity level and also make use of advanced centrifuges, among other things. Well, some analysts regard this as the first reaction to the Friday assassination of an outstanding Iranian nuclear scientist. The Iranian parliament speaker has stressed the move signals the end of the one-sided game as regards the Iran nuclear deal, or the JCPOA.
Iran's parliament or majlis has endorsed a bill titled Strategic Action to Remove Sanctions and Protect the Rights of the Iranian Nation. The legislation, which still requires the endorsement of Iran's Guardian Council, is aimed at tackling U.S.-imposed sanctions against the country. The bill obliges the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran to produce uranium enriched at 20% purity for peaceful purposes and store inside the country at least 120 kilograms of the product annually. The bill also mandates the installation and operation of advanced IR-2M and IR-6 centrifuges. Furthermore, it calls for a metallic uranium production plant to be put into operation in the central city of Isfahan. The Iranian lawmakers have also demanded the optimization and relaunching of Arak's heavy water reactor and the designing of another such facility. The bill also stipulates that Iran will withdraw from the additional protocol to the non-proliferation treaty if the remaining parties to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal do not fully comply with their obligations and restrictions against Iran's trade continue to remain in place. The bill comes after repeated complaints by Iran that is not reaping the fruits of the nuclear agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, while it's remained committed to the agreement.
Truth of the matter again is that the gap and the key gap and the key point of concern was a serious lack of commitment by the West, either in the United States or the European Union, that resulted in new courses of action taken by Iran.
Under the deal, Iran imposed restrictions on its nuclear program in return for sanctions relief. However, U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018 and imposed the toughest ever sanctions under a so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Despite the U.S. move, Tehran remained fully compliant with the JCPOA for an entire year. But amid the failure of the remaining signatories to deliver the benefits of the deal to Iran, the country began a gradual suspension of its commitments. The timing of the approval of the bill is also noteworthy as it comes just days after the assassination of prominent Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh near Tehran. In fact, an informed source has told Press TV that the bill is indeed Iran's first practical response to the assassination. Bakhrizadeh's killing is the latest in a long line of assassination of Iran's nuclear scientists blamed on Israel. Iran has vowed revenge, and judging by the swiftness and decisiveness of the parliament bill, the culprits and masterminds of the killing should be on tenterhooks.
Now, without much further ado, let's get to the point and start the show. Joining me will be peace and justice activists and analysts Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi from the Iranian city of Qom and writer and political commentator Shabir Hassan Ali, who's joining us out of Leicester. Good to have both of you, gentlemen. Welcome. Let's go to Iranian city of Qom. The Iranian parliament argues, Sarbaz, that enough is enough and that the one-sided compliance with a nuclear deal should come to an end. Let's have your comment on that.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I think what the Iranian parliament did was actually, as it was mentioned, the first solid step as a reaction to the assassination that took place on Friday, in which prominent Iranian nuclear scientist Dr. Mohsen Taghizadeh was, you know, martyred. A couple of hours after the assassination, there was a statement on behalf of the supreme leader of Iran, Imam Khamenei, where it was mentioned, 2 points were highlighted in that statement. The first point was that there should be a retaliation, there should be a revenge to anyone who has done this evil act. Second was the path and the move and the, you know, the process that Dr. Taghizadeh was following should be followed. It should not be stopped and it should be pursued again. And the decision that took place today, the decision of the Iranian parliament, was actually a response to that, because decision of the Iranian parliament today is actually paving the path for development of the Iranian nuclear technology for its peaceful goals. And it is actually because there were restrictions after JCPOA, when Iranians admitted to sign JCPOA. Naturally speaking, there were sort of restrictions on the development of the Iranian nuclear facilities, Iranian nuclear science, and those who were the system that was working on the nuclear technology and development of Iran. So now, by this act of the Iranian parliament, the problems, the obstacles in front of this progress is actually removed. So this means that the process and the goal that the prominent Iranian, scientist Fakhrizadeh was looking after, was, working for that, is now in a better, condition. Those who are working in this field of technology will now actually find, a better environment in front of them to follow their researches. And this is the biggest response on behalf of the Iranians to the Zionist regime. It was mentioned that, analytically speaking, all evidences are showing that behind this act of assassination is the Zionist regime. So the decision of the Iranian parliament, which was on its proper time, actually showed that Iran has the will for continuation of the path that someone like Dr. Fakhrizadeh was following.
Okay.
And I hope that this is actually a game-changing decision by the Iranian parliament.
Right. Now, turning to Leicester, Shabir, Iranian legislators want the sanctions lifted as soon as possible. Is this too much they're asking for, more than 2.5 years after the U.S. pull out from the deal and the reimposition of sanctions?
I think, first of all, I'd like to extend condolences to the Supreme Leader and to yourself and to all of the Iranians on the martyrdom of Dr. Fakhrizadeh. In terms of the sanctions, I think really Iran needs to get a grip now. This idea of sanctions, they're not going away. Whether Iran cuts down its nuclear program, whether Iran does, whatever, the sanctions are not going away until and unless Iran gives up being an Islamic revolutionary country. That's what they want. I was just watching a clip from an interview given by the pick by the Biden administration for the National Security Advisor. And you could almost remove his face and put Pompeo's face, and he was saying the same thing. The key points they have a problem with is Iran's ballistic missile program and Iran's, as they say, support for terrorism, which is support for Ansar Allah, support for Hezbollah, support for Hamas, support for the resistance axis. This is what they want. as long as Iran is doing this, I think we need to be very clear. The sanctions from America, at least, and Europe, are not going anywhere. But on that note, Iran doesn't need America or EU. Iran has allies like Russia, like China, like other countries, the BRICS nations. And Iran can build things itself. Iran is a very strong country. It's a country that's been around far longer than America and Europe put together. Iran shouldn't be bending the knee and acting weak in front of these. I think the move that they made today in Parliament is brilliant, but long overdue. They should do it. They should have done it earlier. They should have never signed this capitulation agreement called JCPOA. Because this agreement, I don't know if any people remember, the moment it was signed in 2015, it was signed, the UN sanctions were removed, and US sanctions were applied by Obama, who everyone said was a saint and was so wonderful. Right. These people are all the same, they're all criminals. And Iran needs to, like, strengthen itself and listen to what Imam Khamenei is saying. That the days of sanctions, halas, make the sanctions irrelevant. Change the system, change the way they operate, remove the impact of these sanctions. The sanctions are irrelevant. They hurt America and other countries far more than they hurt Iran. If Iran strengthens itself and does its reliance on God like it did before.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sarbaz, observers saying that the parliament plan is actually Iran's first reaction to the assassination of its eminent nuclear scientists. What's Tel Aviv trying to accomplish by virtue of this state terrorism launching against Iran?
You know, look behind to the history of Zionist regime, you will find that this is a regime that initiated its life with terror. They started, you know, grabbing the land of Palestinians by terror groups of Haganah and blah, 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 other groups who were entering the villages and, you know, beheading the people and, you know, spreading this violence and this terror in the villages to grab the land of the Palestinians. Later on, if you follow the dynamics between this regime and other Arab countries, we see that when Egypt in the 50s tried to, you know, develop its ballistic missiles by the use of a group of the German scientists who were shifted to Cairo to help the Egyptians during the time of Jamal Abdel Nasser to develop their ballistic missile technology, Israel started its acts of terror, and those, you know, German scientists were one by one assassinated. And it was the process resulted in a stop, and all those, you know, German team, they left Egypt because they were feeling their, you know, terror attacks, you know, threatening them. Later on in the 80s, the same thing took place to Iraq when the regime of Iraq, Saddam at that time, was looking after developing some nuclear weapons by the help of the some of you know, European countries such as France. Again, the same series of the terror acts took place. The same thing took place against Syria in 2007, 2006. But don't forget, this is the reality. I mean, the terror is the reality of the Zionist regime. They are alive, so-called alive nowadays, because of their terror policy. But this terror policy is not going to work against Iran. Iran is not Iraq. Iran even is not Egypt. You know, there are differences between Iran and other countries. And even if Israel is going to stop the process of development of Iran by the use of these terror strategies, it's very clear that they are going to defeat. Because what they did, if you look behind these 10 years of the history, 10, 15 years of histories of these terrors, you should know that the terror process of the Iranian scientists, nuclear scientists, did not start at 2010. It started at 2007 when Dr. Ardashir Hossein Pour, as the first Iranian nuclear scientist who was assassinated, actually there was still analysis going on, but he was poisoned by gas, and most possibly it was done by Mossad in 2007, later on in 2010, Dr. Ali Mohammadi, 2011, 12. But one important point is that you should remember that the father of the Iranians missile technology, Shahid Tehrani Mokaddam, General Tehrani Mokaddam, who was, you know, martyred in 2011, was known to be as the father of Iranian missile technology. There are also some analysis telling that event that took place in شهید تهران مقدمات مارتد. It was also a sabotage, you know, act of the Zionist regime as well.
Right.
But within eight years, from 2011, when Shahid Tehrani Muqaddam, the father of the Iranian missile technology, was martyred in Tehran, within 8 years, the Iranian missiles hit the American base in Ain al-Assad in Iraq in 2019. So the elimination, the physical elimination of the Iranian scientists and Iranian prominent figures by the terrorist acts of the Zionist regime is not going to work, as it did not work related to the Iranian, missile technology. The same is going to take place. And after this, as I mentioned, after the decision of the Iranian parliament, it's very clear. It's a system.
Right.
It's not a matter of a few people here and there that you eliminate them and you will stop the process. Stop the process. That's not going to work.
Now, Shabir, some observers argued that this recent assassination of the Iranian scientists was meant to hinder diplomacy with Iran. Are you of the same opinion?
I think what the Netanyahus and Trumps of the world, the less diplomatic terrorists, if you like, what they wanted was to create a situation where Iran does a knee-jerk reaction to this, starts a war, and halas. And so, yes, they are scared of the nuclear deal, the dead nuclear deal, somehow coming back, because it's very strange. Look, Mossad, CIA, all of these people, they know that this nuclear deal is not anything to do with Iran's nuclear power, ambitions, and work. The entire thing is about Iran's support for the resistance axis and Iran's ballistic missile program and defense program, and its alliance with Russia and China and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing to do with the nuclear program. The nuclear program is, everyone knows, this has been proven time and time again, even by the CIA, by NSA, by Mossad, all of them know this. It's just the media that keeps saying nuclear weapons. They know that Imam Khamenei has said nuclear weapons are prohibited. So they will keep on trying to do this. Now, the reason for the deal, why these people don't like the deal, is because, as far as they see, it alleviated, in quotes, some sanctions. And yes, maybe alleviated one or two types of sanctions, maybe. But the reality is, it's more psychological. They don't want someone to come and do a deal with Iran again.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, a deal with America, anyone who has studied the history of deals that America has made with Iran or with anyone else, you cannot make a deal with America. First of all, America is an infantile country. It's a country whose administration and as an entity, it's less than 300 years old, of which 240 or 250 of those years, it's been in a state of war. It's never had a chance to mature. America is not capable of negotiating fairly and honorably with anyone, even its own neighbors. I mean, this is just like the situation we have in the UK, where the UK is unable to negotiate with even its neighbors for a deal. This negotiation talk, it's a placebo. It doesn't really solve anything.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is, what they want is they want Iran to abandon its ballistic missile program that Sarbaz Ruhullah just spoke about, headed up by Aghay Tehrani Muqaddam, Marta Tehrani Muqaddam, and they want Iran to stop its support of the resistance axis, and especially of the Palestinians. If Iran was to do this, then they will negotiate and they will throw money into Iran. They will make Iran everything. They will make Iran a heaven on earth in terms of the Western and the materialist eyes. But Iran will betray the revolution and the blood of the thousands, hundreds of thousands that died in making the victory of the revolution and the 8-year imposed war and so on and so forth, if Iran was to do that. And Iran won't. Iran is a resilient country. It's wise. It's intelligent. And I know many people have been talking about, what's Iran's response going to be? I think, like you have said and the other guest has said, this response by Parliament is one tiny element of it. And the enemy needs to understand that Iran is not a country that will just knee-jerk into anything. Iran will take its time. At the end of the day, one of the key things that Iran manufactures are Persian carpets. And Persian carpets take years to manufacture. Anyone who knows anything about them knows. So Iran has got plenty of patience. But one thing we need to be wary about and be careful about is the Zionists creating a false flag attack in somewhere like the Emirates or somewhere in that region, mm-hmm. blaming it on Iran and using that as a pretext. And I think Dr. Khoshash had spoken about that earlier on, or had written about it earlier on, which people can mm-hmm. find online.
Okay. Now, Sabah Zurella, the European side of JCPOA has only given lip service, as you know, and insisted the deal must be protected. Yet in practice, they haven't done much to allow Iran to benefit economically, as per the agreement. You know, banking operations, business transactions have been blocked, sale of crude is facing obstruction. What's Europe waiting for?
I think Europe has proven to be a puppet of the Americans, and they are highly dependent on the policies of America. So when there is a change of policies in the United States of America, and there's a change of the administration over there, Europe is also changing its stand. So it's exactly the case that you mentioned, that there's nothing beyond lip servicing on behalf of the Europeans. They were not even able to solve the simple issue of SWIFT and simple issue of banking between Iran and the European community, which was so-called independent from the American side of the story, and from the United States side of the story. You know, they were not that involved, but even Europeans were not able to solve that banking process between Iran, because they are so-called, with JCPOA. They by their statements, they condemn the act of terror against Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. They all condemn it. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the reality on the ground, nothing is taking place. And it's all because, unfortunately, still, they are, obedient. They are, followers and puppets of the Americans as well as the Zionists, because of the pressures of the lobby, Zionist lobbies over there, as well as the mm-hmm. dependency of the European countries towards the United States of America, unfortunately.
So if you're Yeah, we have only 1 minute left, if I could put the last question to Shabir. Shabir, what do you anticipate will be the fate of the JCPOA at the threshold of a new administration assuming power at the White House? 1 minute, please.
I think JCPOA is dead. It was dead at the beginning when it was signed. It is dead now. And I mm-hmm. think the people that still think it's alive need to accept that it's dead. The Trump administration, Biden administration, Republican, Democrat, makes no difference. They are the same. And, those people who worked very hard for JCPOA, inshallah, they will be rewarded. They need to sit down, maybe go through the grieving process, do a Fatiha, as we do when someone passes away, and realize that there is no deal with the U.S. or with the Western powers right. until they treat Iran as an equal. If they don't, then they can go to hell.
Okay, so it's like flogging dead horse, in your opinion. Thank you very much for your comments and contribution. We had peace and justice activists and allies.